so you can give you some idea of the lecture you might have had if I had had a chance to do everything. And there's plenty of pizza, so help some wine and pizza for... We begin. Pizza, some more wine. And we have more wine at the break, I guess. Okay, here's how we're going to operate. I'm going to actually just do this as if it were a ordinary talk with one proviso, namely that, let's see how it works, various amounts of lights off. I'm going to, in order, because I want to get as much of the argument as possible, see how that looks. Oh, all of you disappeared. Is that okay to see, or do you need the other light off? That's all right? Okay. So we're going to go about an hour. It will just, because I want you to hear the whole argument, I'm going to go for about an hour and 15 minutes, at which point we will have a break. And then any questions on this, on any bit of Kant, and anything else, we'll just keep going until they throw us out of the building. Okay? Which, of course, they will do eventually. They always do. Okay. The title of the paper is The Demand for Ugliness, Picasso's Bodies, and it comes with two epigraphs. The first from Nietzsche. Nietzsche says, "The demand for ugliness, the older Hellenes' good, severe will to pessimism, to the tragic myth, to affirm the image of all that is fearsome, wicked, mysterious, annihilating, and fateful in the very foundations of existence. Where must the origins of tragedy have lain at that time?" And then a little epigraph from Hegel, where I take it he's saying exactly the same thing that Nietzsche just said. I don't see any difference between Hegel and Nietzsche. This is personal standard, but this is Hegel. "This is the tremendous power of the negative. It is the energy of thought, of the pure I, death. Beauty hates the understanding for asking of her what it cannot do. But the life of spirit is not the life that shrinks from death and keeps itself untouched by devastation, but rather the life that endures it and maintains itself in it. It wins its truth only when, in utter dismemberment, it finds itself. So this is a paper about ugliness and death and dismemberment. The opposites of beauty. Directly opposite the first page of Umberto Eco's Introduction to On Ugliness, his virtual encyclopedia of ugliness, is Pablo Picasso's Weeping Woman from 1937. Weeping Woman is a signature work of modernist painting, as well as Picasso's entire oeuvre. Eco presents Picasso's iconic painting because it exemplifies that version of ugliness that has become one of the constitutive gestures of modern painting, hence how painting continues to mean for us modern subjects. To subtract ugliness from modern painting would be to vanquish all the children of Picasso, Picabia, Soutine, Bacon, de Kooning, Pollock, and then much that is in art now, Cindy Sherman, McCarthy, and extreme body art. Picasso's ugly paintings stand at the crossroads of a core debate about Picasso and modernist painting. The matter is direct and simple. On what has become the dominant theory of modernist painting, Picasso's defining artistic achievement is, with Braque, the invention of cubism. One might think of cubism as a version of Enlightenment rationalism in which the magic of perspective and illusionism is replaced by a threefold gesture. First, the frank acknowledgement of the picture plane, its shallow depth and the limited space as where a painting occurs, the site of painterly meaning. Second, the systematic replacement of mimetic forms by geometric forms. Hence, third, the incremental displacement of representation, significant content, by abstraction, formal content. On one reading of this trajectory, cubism also thereby involves the de-skilling of artistic technique in the direction of mechanical technique as part of a general critique of subjectivity in art. That is, a critique of all that went under the honorifics of individuality, originality, and genius. Cubism sought to move painting in the direction of a formally purified and shareable practice. It meant something to both Braque and Picasso that this was a shared and therefore impersonal and therefore social practice. Assume that cubism is, if not the first, then certainly the defining breakthrough that allows painting to progress towards a rapprochement with photography. It would then follow that Picasso's post-cubist work, more and more, and certainly from 1916 on, becomes a defensive, regressive set of strategies to save painting from the mechanical denouement that cubism itself had definitively launched. Hence, only the advance of to cubism and what can be deciphered as following from it deserves recognition as painterly achievement. All else is reaction and defense, the vanity of subjectivity reasserting itself once more. It is this dominant story about modernism that I want to contest. We need another way of figuring Picasso's modernism, one in which cubism becomes a minor detour in a project whose force field lies elsewhere. My hypothesis is not, of course, that ugliness defines this alternative approach, but rather by tracking Picasso's insistent deployment of ugliness as a painterly strategy, we can prize open an alternative trajectory for painterly modernism generally, a trajectory emphatically opposed to the mechanical, geometric, anti-representational, de-skilling, whose hegemony has proved no more beneficial to art than Greenberg's formless one, of which it is direct descendant. So I have a kind of madly ambitious project here to rewrite the entire structure of modernism based on Picasso's ugly paintings. That's the project. For this purpose, and for these purposes, what I want to do this evening is claim, I'm going to call it an ugly romantic Picasso in opposition to a beautiful cubist Picasso. Here, in three sentences, is my hypothesis. There are two irreducible, transcendental schemas for the representation of space: geometry and the human body. Since the representation of space is a necessary condition for the representation of the world in general, then geometry and the human body are, in the setting of modern painting, competing transcendental frameworks for making perceptual experience of the world possible. Picasso's ugly paintings are part of a wider attempt to demonstrate that the human body is a material a priori for the space of painting, and hence for perceptual experience generally. In brief, Picasso, like Matisse, could not conceive of giving up representation because he took the human body as providing the necessary conditions for the possibility of painting in general. The human body is not merely an object to be represented, grasped, captured, depicted. It is simultaneously the condition of representation. Ugliness is, at a certain moment in our history, the necessary means for disclosing this truth about the meaning of painting. In this setting, ugliness is on the side of materiality and truth, and beauty on the side of ideality an illusion. Kant's own account of space as a priori governed by Euclidean geometry presses in the direction of cubism. His notion of reflective judgment, I would suggest, pushes in the opposing direction.
It's going to be a pain in the neck all night.
I want to approach my espousal of ugliness sideways on by first looking at a paper of T.J. Clark's entitled The Ordinary Optimism of Picasso, in which he too is attempting to salvage the post-cubist Picasso from the ravages of dead-end cubism. His case turns on the wonderful Woman by the Sea, which is in the Met, so something you can go visit tomorrow if you wish. Following Michel Larrey's magnificent suggestion that each new object or combination of forms in Picasso represents a new instrument for inserting ourselves more humanly in nature, enabling us to become more concrete, more dense, more alive, Clark's project appears to be to redeem this moment of Picasso by construing monstrosity. In between 26 and 34, Picasso's paintings are full of monsters, as an infantilism that, by retreating to a moment prior to the separation between subject and object, discovers in the heart of subjectivity an image of the other, an image of the other before there are any others, hence a transcendental otherness. In capturing an image of the other prior to the existence of others, Clark avers that Picasso is providing at least some of these monsters with pictorial authenticity and authority. But this is a carefully measured and critically qualified support on Clark's part. Although the woman by the sea is a freak, she is unaware of her monstrousness. She faces the world without the concept of beauty, yet having violated her mind. Her lack of self-consciousness in part licenses her authoritative presence for us. But this is not to say that no norms or forms of ideality effectively govern her presentation. On the contrary, and it is this that orients Clark's account of her. What matters, he says, is her standing and solidity. Standing and solidity are Clark's substitute for the rule of beauty. It is why he associates monstrosity with monumentality, and why, after quoting Dalí, he throws down the gauntlet and says that nonetheless, his too humanist notion will certainly fail in the face of Grand Nu au Fauteuil Rouge. But some careful editing occurs in posting this challenge. He says that the exercise of using the large nude as an instrument to insert ourselves more fully in the material world, to become concrete and dense, is surely bound to fail. And it is true that the nude's boneless, amoeba-like, nearly liquid draping of herself fails to enable a deepening of bodily concreteness and density. But Clark has dropped the last item of Larry's account, becoming more alive. And surely for Larry, density and concreteness are meant as qualifications of aliveness. Is that large nude not weirdly, monstrously, and uncomfortably alive? Her tilted head, open mouth, and teeth are like a material quiver of the death drive itself. Even if he balks at the large nude, Clark knows this thought. He knows that monstrosity is vitality. But by the time this grudging acknowledgement is offered, sufficient barriers have been erected to allow him to immediately disclaim the insight. Greenberg is right, even this can become a formula. By choosing Woman by the Sea as his exemplary case of monstrosity, Clark seeks to normalize, to sublimate monstrosity. All that uprightness and standingness and bodily presence as again substitutes for beauty. But this begs the question of the stakes here, since it detaches monstrosity from its obvious aesthetic equivalent, ugliness. Ugliness plays no part in this paper, which, given its other themes, is curious. From Les Demoiselles d'Avignon in 1907, Picasso is not merely risking ugliness by transgressing existing aesthetic norms, but contesting what he had come to regard as the shallow illusoriness, the emptiness of modern art as premised on female beauty. Female beauty as the figure and bearer of art beauty, and he's doing so through ugliness. Ugliness from the get-go is a means of disenchanting art, of seeking an authenticity for painting not dependent on the easy attractions of the female form or the seductions of pictorial illusion. As Elizabeth Cowley nicely states the thesis, his revolutionary purpose was to claim the right to regenerate contemporary art through harshness, brutality, fearsomeness, disharmony. Les Demoiselles, and I'm going to come back and talk about this painting for about a half an hour later on, so I'll have a lot of chance to think about it. Les Demoiselles is, of course, an immensely powerful painting, and its power can feel like a mode of beauty, a terrible beauty. But after the failure of Cubism, and in the light of Surrealism, Picasso would return to this impulse. He would learn how to make irrevocably ugly paintings, as no one before him ever had. That's The Dance from 1925, and that same year, The Kiss. Head of a Woman with Self-Portrait. And then there's a whole series of Weeping Women pictures from the late 30s, and the kind of famous Man with a Lollipop. Picasso's explicitly ugly works are internally related to the pictures of, or meant to cause, horror. Ugliness is not a side issue for Picasso, but a constitutive element of what modern painting, hence modernism, must want for itself. In The Algerian Women and Picasso at Large, Leo Steinberg persuasively argues concerning Les Demoiselles that in their absolute presence, Picasso's ominous horrors, Picasso's ominous horrors stage a terrifying de-sublimation of art. The picture, he says, breaks the triple spell of tradition: idealization, emotional distance, and fixed focus perspective. The tradition of high-craft illusionism, which conducts the spectator unobserved to his privileged seat. I won't go through it. I have several pages now talking about how even Steinberg, in thinking about ugliness, can't bear to allow it in. And he just retreats and retreats and retreats, and he introduces a word devenestation, and then gives us a whole paragraph in about Latin origins of devenestation, and goes on and on. He too, although he recognizes that ugliness is what this is all about, he can't bear to let it in. My objection to his retreat is that it transforms the desublimation that he says ugliness performs into nothing more than a parlor trick. So, in order to forge another Picasso, I think this is the crucial work. My interrogation of Les Demoiselles is not directed toward its art historical Picasso's intentions, but rather the more basic one of what he accomplished in this painting, what it achieves for painting in relation to our capacity to care about it through going ugly. And again, for Picasso, there existed a nearly one-to-one relation between art beauty and female beauty, that art secured a space of beautiful appearances for itself through the recruitment of the beauty of woman. Hence the thought that subtending our willingness to accede to the beauty of a work of art is the desire licensed by the female form. And I think it's worthwhile reminding ourselves a of what Picasso thought he needed to subvert if modern painting was to continue. Not only the sublime examples of Ingres, who was never far from Picasso's mind, from the more or less discreet early paintings like the Vaupassant Bather, and even more famously, Le Grand Odalisque, but to The Source, which is a late painting, and then a painting that is actually commented upon by Les Demoiselles, namely The Turkish Bath. And the
you'll see when we go back to Les Demoiselles, it too has a dish in the front that leads on to the scene of nudity. It's plainly a commentary on this. But of course, it wasn't just Ingres that Picasso was thinking about. It is equally thinking about what is now, for me, and I just have to confess this, I find almost impossibly hard to take and too absurd, even kitsch, are the Renoir nudes, like this faux discretion of the bather arranging her hair, to what to me now looks like the paradigm case of the male gaze, the fantasizing, idealizing of female sexual availability in Les Dormeuses. If these examples seem too extreme to take seriously, Picasso was more explicitly attempting to distance himself from Matisse's recent efforts, from Bonheur de Vivre from 1905-6, which Cowling describes as rapturously sensual and joyous, which nonetheless, I should remind you, welcomes the spectator in as emphatically as Ingres invited him into the Turkish bath, or Renoir invited his libidinous gaze to devour the sleeping bather. If Matisse denaturalizes the invitation, the rule of beauty and idealization remain. A year later, 1907, Matisse will outrage and puzzle visitors to the Salon des Indépendants with blue nude memory of Biskra. Matisse's partially realized ambition here was to invoke an explosive sexuality, his presumption doubtless being that the more flagrant the sexuality, the more honest or truthful the work. It is that equation that fails. Matisse's work is evidently fantasized, a Western nostalgic mythologizing of a primitive North Africa. Not only is the painting's primitivism and pastoral vision an overcooked fantasy, but it is impossible to now ignore how that fantasy remains essentially a vehicle for the elaboration of male desire. Her self-possessed sexuality, all the more for the sake of the desiring spectator. All this changes with Les Demoiselles. Kahnweiler summarized the first reactions to the painting's brutality and ugliness as an assault on the viewer. The picture he painted seemed to everyone mad or monstrous. So maybe you're not aware, but it was painted 1908, finished, and did not get exhibited for another 10 years. Everyone hated it. Alice Toklas, Stein tells us, says it made her nauseous. Other people ran. Matisse shook his head. And there's a famous art critic who said, you know, oh, what a waste of a great artist. He's now finished. And it didn't enter the repertoire of modern painting until the late 20s. So it was undigestible. I mean, we've now become used to it, but it was for almost 20 years really an impossible painting. And I want to try to, at least as I reconstruct some of its complexities, to get some of that impossibility or difficulty that it presents
I do think it is the breakthrough painting for modernism. So if you're going to make an absurd claim, make it strong. Here's my absurd claim. This is the turning point in modernist painting. Recall, and in order to do this, of course, I'm going to philosophically heft up the story. Recall Steinberg's summary account of the demoiselle's accomplishments. Again, the picture breaks the triple spell of tradition. Idealization, emotional distance, and fixed focus perspective. The tradition of high craft illusionism, which conducts the spectator unobserved to his privileged seat. Notice how, for Steinberg, the triple spell of tradition operates in order to place the unobserved spectator in a privileged position. Contemplator, beholder, possessor of what was beheld. So just go back, right? The structure is to allow us to be the ideal spectator of that. In order to break the spell, the beholder must himself become beheld. In being beheld, he must become undone, that is, lose the privilege of emotional distance. And in order to become beheld and undone, the pictorial surface must become disordered. Not incoherent, but emphatically not arranged for the sake of licensing the privileged scene of one contemplator looking in on the depicted scene. Hence, breaking the rule of fixed focus perspective. So I want to argue that we have to undo those threefold things. And I want to say for a moment what they amount to. And it's all about Kant. Let me address the disordering of fixed focus perspective first. It's going to be my wedge. My hypothesis here is that Picasso deploys what is best thought of as the painterly equivalent of parataxis. Do you know that word, all of you? Parataxis. Parataxis, in order to accomplish the systematic disordering. Literally, parataxis is a form of syntactic ordering in which the sheer juxtaposition of elements, placing one thing just next to another, replaces the hierarchical ordering governed by logical concepts. If then, because, X, if X, then necessarily Y, and so forth. With parataxis, there's no hierarchical ordering. Rather, two things are placed next to one another, and what can be made of their connection must be made through the content involved in their sheer contiguity. Adorno contends that what Steinberg calls the spell of the tradition, leading the spectator to its privileged seat, is really the spell of a unifying ego, subordinating the multiplicity of the world to its instrumental ends by conceptual synthesis. That is, by unifying the complex many under a system of hierarchical subordination. Now, since in painting, it is high craft illusionism that lends the spectator his privileged position, then it can usefully be considered as equivalent to painting's version of transcendental idealism. So, first equivalent equation I'm making is the tradition of high art illusionism is painting's version of transcendental idealism, with the ideal spectator replacing the transcendental ego, and the three mechanisms of idealization, emotional distance, and fixed focus perspective as the forms of synthesis that subordinate pictorial space to ideal unity. In all of this, the female body is the fundament and support of the entire system. Painterly parataxis, I want to argue, is the key to Picasso's art, and Les Demoiselles is the founding instance. Parataxis is its orienting device. In claiming this, I am doing no more than giving a procedural and aesthetic name to what Leo Steinberg critically described in his remarkable essay, The Philosophical Brothel. The Philosophical Brothel was the original name for this painting, which everyone supposes was given to it by Apollinaire, who was the one person who seemed not to be offended by it, but seemed to love it. But it's a name that didn't stick, alas. I wish it had been said that. Obviously thinking about Sade, right? I mean, that's what Apollinaire must have been thinking about. Consider the most obvious instance. Now I'm going to talk about how the painting works. Consider the most obvious instance of parataxis. The far left figure's left hand, which appears, or would appear, which appears to float disconnected above her head. Without the organizing syntactical mediation of arm length and distance. What are we to make of this? Steinberg thinks we should assume that Picasso here wanted an oblique recession pursued by an implied outstretched arm raised at 30 degrees. The disconnectedness of the hand at the visible terminus of the stretch then becomes emblematic of maximum distance. So this, right? But all we see is the hand above the head. Steinberg then lays out what it means to be employing a parataxic formula at this juncture. The aim is to express the recession of this upper flap, not through linear or aerial perspective, not by way of color or physical clues, such as overlaps, but through the suasion of gesture. The supposed necessity of an omitted arm between head and hand, a saccadic leap offered only to our anatomic intuition. Our anatomic intuition here does the work formally done for us by linear perspective. In making sense of her gesture in this way, we become responsible for the integrity of her body, its integrity up to us, up to the viewer, and achieved only through the viewer instead of something offered up to him. The next nude presents more ferocious problems. Her left leg does not appear to reach down to the ground. Rather, the left foot appears draped over her right shin, with the right leg simply disappearing. Given the slight bend of her right knee, we are forced to conclude that she is not, in fact, standing. At one point in the preparatory studies, she was sitting in a chair with her left leg crossed over her right. In subsequent studies, her chair dissolves and she sinks back, disposing herself at last like an odalisque. She ends up recumbent, but, Steinberg says, seen in bird's eye perspective. The idea of verticalizing a supine figure has precedence. What nonetheless makes the idea so difficult to hold in place here is that she is given to us as nearly vertical to the picture plane while placed in utter adjacency to the, in fact, vertical nudes on either side of her. Everything about how Steinberg goes on to describe her heightens the extraordinary parataxic formulation Picasso is working. She rests, recessive, but still extended, insulated in her own rocking space capsule. Adjacency without nearness. Withdrawal without attenuation of presence. The full-length projection of her, claiming undiminished scope in the field, makes the beholder work harder. One has to push mental levers to keep an erected gisante lying down. So the claim here is that this figure is in fact lying down, must be given her posture, and she's simply been tilted up. Okay. Once we are alerted to her posture and the disposition of her limbs, we know that the second nude must be lying down, but given her location in the painting, the lack of recession from knee to hand, and her consequent vertical relation to the picture plane, we are never going to see her as fully recumbent. We cannot ascend to the aerial view offered without losing our viewing perspective altogether. I spent hours trying to make her lie down. And you're just, and, you know, trying to see what it would like to, just can't do it. Being unable to see her as she must be seen automatically buckles illusionist pretense. Illusion is just what we are missing here. But that is also what we are missing in her relation to the women on either side of her. Her apparent verticality. Splinters or fragments the demoiselle's space of habitation so that each possesses her own space as defined by posture and gesture, a bodily space without there being any space they are emphatically in. They are truly juxtaposed one to the other across the picture plane. Said differently, each nude possesses her own space in light of her bodily being. Hence, each nude provides orientation and structure for the picture as a whole, which is as much to say that none does. The idea of the picture as a whole, let's now go into scare quotes. Each nude is a center, a place, and an orientation. Hence, each demands acknowledgement separately from her companions. Each nude becomes related to her companions through literal adjacency on the picture plane, on the one hand, and through being related by the observer to the space implied by bodily posture. Hence, in the same way in which, in the case of the floating hand, the observer must go through anatomical intuition, connect hand to body, so generally, through the possibilities of bodily orientation, the observer now is responsible for making room for spacing the nudes in relation to one another in space. However, and this is however that I think most critics fail to get, this effort will fail because the bodies provide clues only sufficient for the possibility of their spatial relation to one another without enough systematic detail or systematic relating of one bodily amplified space to another to turn possibility into actuality. This scene can be registered, but it cannot be surveyed or constructed. This is as much to say that these bodies are the space of this painting. It emerges from them and collapses back on them. Okay, you want to resist this claim, I know. I'm going to make it really work by thinking about the final figure on the right. The fierce and wildly disorienting realization with the squatting nude. While it is natural to read her as sitting with her back to the viewer, her head rapidly swiveling around at his entrance, there is sufficient counter-evidence in the other direction. above all that she cast both eyes on the intruder, her head hence so frontal as to make a back view improbable, an hypothesis underlined by the way in which her boomerang hand cups her face mask. Try figuring out how her hand could... Conversely, the hint of backbone and disappearing pigtail.
I can't quite see it, but there's the disappearing pigtail, and there's a liminal backbone there.
Push in the imposing in the opposite direction, as does the hint of a single breast just below her armpit. Picasso's elision of thumbs, the purely angular thrust of arms and elbows, and I think his paratactic coup, she has no neck. Her head simply sits on top of her body. All these together leave the position of this nude systematically ambiguous. As Steinberg rightly comments, her flattened impress orients itself simultaneously inward and outward. Which is to say, this is not about flatness, but about a spatiality that emanates from her body alone. Her body possesses, even exhibits, multiple perspectives, hence a spatial depth concomitant with each perspectival take, while in remaining systematically ambiguous, irresolvable and unmasterable, also remaining... thereby unavailable. There is no place from which she can actually be seen. I almost want to say that she possesses all the conditions for seeability while not actually being seen. And of course, the final twist is no accident. For all her outrageous exposure, explicitness, and savagery, she sees more than is seen, as do they all. Thinking through what is at stake here is complicated. Well, summarizing his account, Steinberg states that overnight, the contrived coherencies of representational art, the feigned unities of time and place, the stylistic consistencies, all were declared to be fictional. The demoiselle confessed itself a picture conceived in duration and delivered in spasms. In this one work, Picasso discovered that the demands of discontinuity could be met on multiple levels. By cleaving depicted flesh, by elision of limbs and abbreviation, by slashing the web of connecting space, by abrupt changes of vantage, and by a sudden stylistic shift at the climax. Finally, the insistent staccato of the presentation was found to intensify the picture's address and symbolic charge. The beholder, instead of observing a room full of lazing whores, is targeted from all sides. So, if you line yourself up and you go to the Met, you stand in front of it, they're all looking at you. You're the object. You're subjected to their not very pleasant gazes. As Steinberg pointedly concludes, the upshot of Picasso's fragmentary style, called Picasso's painterly recovery of the romantic fragment, is the dislocation of viewer from his privileged position until he becomes targeted from all sides. The painting's subject, that is, who or what is subjective, done and undone by the nude's piercing, freezing looks. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. In the viewer losing the privilege of viewing subject and becoming subjected to the cool or harassing view of the views of these women, the meaning of body alters radically. Begin with the obvious. These bodies do not invite possession. None are feminine, and none is presented as expressly sexual. They are large, anti-sensual, mannish women with thick thighs, angular, narrow-waisted bodies, breasts when presented at all, more often than not pointed rather than round. The three on the left have small slits for mouths, while the mouths of the two masphere's open in tight surprise to hoot an unreadable denigration of the interloper. If the posture of the two sensual nudes acknowledges a sexual situation, acknowledges their in principle sexual availability, their eyes, bolted on the intruder, bespeak a saturnine indifference, as if nothing about their bodies, above all their nakedness, their exposure, should be taken as wanting or welcoming or needing anything. On the contrary. The first and most obvious conclusion to be drawn here is a generalization of the conclusion already drawn about the body and spatiality. Because these bodies cannot be possessed, because that is the implacable, because of the implacable character of these bodies, their unavailability, together with their possession of their own objectifying gaze, then the natural link between seeing and desire is broken. The desire to see, that is the paradigmatic sublimation of the desire to sexually possess, that was classically fulfilled through the ecstatic vision of female beauty, is here emphatically severed and negated. But since the classical vision of beauty was a fantasy, and no less fantastical in Matisse than in Ingres, then Picasso's painting, precisely in its implacableness, its non-surveyability, and its interruption and dismantling of the possessive gaze, strikes out toward truth against fantasy. In overcoming of illusion, its overcoming of illusion is the mark of its truthfulness, its authenticity. It is, or indeed I would want to argue, the first true painting of the 20th century. Ugliness, in its unmasking, brings material truth against idealist illusion. Well, what is that truth? Again, a generalization from the body gives space thesis seems necessary. If the depicted bodies are not the final objects of pictorial perception, because seeing them is not the consummation of pictorial viewing, then these bodies are the conditions of possibility of pictorial experience. It's material a priori. As each demoiselle provides her own space, so each more generally opens up the very possibility of there being something intelligible, meaningful, to be seen. These bodies, in their implacable there-ness, create, open, make possible a perceptual relation to the world in general. Perception leans on them. If this were an essay on Adorno's aesthetics, I would say that Picasso gives the Copernican turn here a twist toward the object, shifting from the identity thinking of beauty to the non-identity of ugliness. Only a framework having this breadth does anything like justice to Picasso's revolution. Let me unpack this claim a bit more by slowly making my way back to Clark's Bather by the Sea. And I'm going to... Do I want to do this? Let me do this a bit slowly. I want to begin with a passage from Hegel's Introduction to the Lectures on Fine Art, where things go terribly wrong. The passage is one in which Hegel is pressing his case for privileging art beauty over natural beauty. But this is not so easily done, as he acknowledges, because generally we are wont to prize life over death. But this raises a problem for art, since while organisms are teleologically arranged down to their smallest parts, the work of art, this is Hegel, attains the appearance of life only on its surface. Inside, it is ordinary stone or wood and canvas, or as in poetry, an idea expressed in speech and letters. So far, so good. Now comes the incriminating passage, one which follows directly from what has been said, but somehow makes art impossible. But this aspect, external existence, is not what makes a work into a product of fine art. It is a work of art only because, being the offspring of mind, it continues belong to the realm of mind, has received the baptism of the spiritual, and only represents that which has been molded in harmony with spirit. What makes this passage particularly unintelligible as an account of art is that it eliminates from art the very elements that distinguish art from pure conceptuality. The dead stuff that provides for art's being a sensuous realization of the idea. But as Hegel elsewhere acknowledges, happily, it is the material media of art that provide the excess of sensuousness and so of immediacy and feeling over conceptuality. Philosophy, inhabiting the realm of pure conceptuality, unburdened by sensuous particularity, may be higher for Hegel, but even for him this comes with a cost, precisely in concreteness, density, actuality, immediacy. And yet Hegel is not wrong in reminding us that paint, canvas, etc. are just dead stuff. So how does the dead stuff get its meaning? That's the puzzle. I take this to be the paradox of art, a paradox that presses in harder on painting than any other art form. And I think it goes like this. How can the excess of art over conceptual meaning be located in its material sensuousness if art's materiality is finally nothing but dead matter, pigments on canvas? My operating hypothesis is that from 1907 on, Picasso always had this question, or the challenge implicit in it, at the back of his mind, if not always at the front, and that he knew in his bones that painting could only fully come to itself, authorize itself, if it could square this circle. Now there is one place where the axis of dead matter versus living material meets the axis of meaning versus dead matter, and that is paradigmatically the human body, but also necessarily all living bodies. The human body, in its sheer material givenness, this is what I'm going to try to prove in the next 10 minutes, the human body, in its sheer material givenness, in its matter-of-fact material self-presentation, is alive and a source of meaning, meaningful in its simple aliveness. The human body, or more precisely, the appearance form of the human body, human bodily form, itself means, and means beyond, before, and after, and how we intentionally mean it. So the human body, in its sheer being there, standing or sitting, not even moving, means. And what it means, first of all, is aliveness, or deadness, which for the body is a mode of aliveness, and hence different from sheer dead matter. Which is to say, it is somehow the human body as itself a material presence in the world that is the original source of meaning rather than consciousness or mind or spirit or language or even desire. Because the body autonomously and automatically means, then the body necessarily organizes visual space. Visual space is a precipitate of the body's inhabiting it. Or at least this becomes Picasso's theme. The body's meaning in excess of, independently of how it is meant. That's why I'm interested in ugliness, right? I'm interested in how the body means in excess of and independently of how it is meant. Or the inevitability, the ineluctable terror or passion of its being meant. All these themes are already there in Les Demoiselles, but require the passage through cubism and its failure to become explicit. Think of this stuttering emergence in this way. Let us concede that consciousness, language, desire are sources not just of meaning, but of ideality, of normative rightness. Beginning with, say, Cézanne, modern art discovered that although it was directed to the presence of the visual world, the terms of its practice were burdened with ideals from elsewhere, ideals that were extrinsic to the sheer material givenness of things. My shorthand for this illusory ideality is beauty. If my argument to here is cogent, the most difficult and therefore most contested thing here must be the human body, above all the female form. So if painting were to achieve an integrity intrinsic to its material practice, they would have to excise all extra bodily meaning from the body. Let the body present itself, be present by itself, which in practice means either presenting it through the negation of its idealized forms or by capturing it before idealization has had a chance to gain access to it. Presenting it through the negation of beauty, through distortion and dismemberment, or capturing the body before beauty. Ugliness hence becomes the necessary means through which painting aspires and can aspire to authentic self-presence. Let's look again at Woman by the Sea. What is startling in his account of her is that Clark leaves out the most salient and unmissable features of this painting, namely that she is, for the most part, constructed, made out of geometric solids. Her head is just a ball, her body a pyramid, her legs rectangles like those of a table, her breasts small, sharply pointed cones, her buttocks half spheres. Moreover, the ball that is her head is without features, just a stone ball, and it is very small in proportion to the rest of her body. Not only does the smallness of her head drive out the possibility that her body is just an extension of her consciousness of herself, or what self-awareness she has might be located in her head, but for the viewer, it eliminates the possibility that in responding to her, we are responding to an expressive, affect-laden, irresistible human face. No Levinas face of the other here. No look or gaze returning our view. If you ever wanted just a simple refutation of Levinas, she's my girl. Insane. I do think that's right. I mean, I think Levinas is absurd, and I think she is the demonstration of that absurdity. Insane that Picasso emphatically presses the fact of her geometric construction, I mean to be insisting that he is allowing in everything a painterly rationalist could want, Here is a body that is nothing but pure geometrical forms, and the purity of her being nothing but a composite of geometrical forms matters not at all to her living presence.
Unlike her digital presence.
In this setting, her geometrical construction is not the source of her meaningful presence, but an explicit form resisting it. The resistance fails at every moment. The geometry of her form is sublated at every moment by its being the form of a human body, with its inevitable grammar of head, trunk, arms, legs, uprightness, etc. Human bodily form effectively sublating, overcoming, and subsuming other contestants to the crown of originating form. We do not breathe life into the human body. We do not project meaning onto it. It exemplifies meaning and life, even as geometrical construction would seek to crush them. Further, Further, I interpret the meaning of Picasso depicting her as standing, as something constructed and indeed as something that's been sculpted from stone, as pressing the fact of her brute materiality, her sheer material presence as opposed to any illusory inwardness. Not only do we not ascribe either soul or sapience to her, but I do not find myself thinking of her as perspicuously sentient either. Not without feeling, exactly, but before feeling, in the same way she is before beauty. So, I take it that she is emphatically turned toward the sun, soaking it in, but there is no heat or hotness here. Her turning and facing thus occurs by way of the way a plant might turn and face the sun. The sun is her medium or element, like the blue of sea and sky. So the metaphorical thought Picasso is after is that her material being in the world is no different in kind than the material life afforded by her painted representation, that with the human body the exchange between obdurate materiality and material meaning is immediate. If I can put these claims in the context of my remarks about Demoiselle, I would say that what is being asked of us here is acknowledgement. Acknowledgement that what is before us is a human body, with everything that means about our attitudes and comportment toward it. That we can feel addressed by the demoiselle and feel a curious empathic identification with the bather, wanting something from her even if we do not know what, is our acknowledgement that she is one of us. And one of us, no matter made of what, no matter how constructed, no matter how hewn, and no matter how geometrically contrived, still this is a human form in the sheer having of head, body, arms, leg, breasts in approximately the right places she means. And she can only mean the way a human form means because there is nothing else for us to acknowledge. Again, Picasso does not represent an existing object, but presents the bodily form necessary for the possibility of representation of the world in general. I take it that's Picasso's transcendental deduction of the possibility of experience. Okay, I'll stop there. Okay, so let us have a, you can fill your wine glasses. Let us have a 15-minute break, and then we will talk about this and any con questions that obviously arise from it. Yeah?
There's a yellowing on the bottom leg and the top arm. Is that
good question.
Or is that sunshine?
Nice question. I'd have to go back and look at the original again, but maybe there's a hint of yellow. It's not impossible. But I don't seem to remember. Does anyone remember whether she has any yellow there? You've stumped. Yeah.